Drop it. NSTYT reporter, Power Panel, what is this?
What? All right. Jordan Chatton, Nomiki Konst. I'm Cenk Uygur. I'm also here. Michael Tracy. So, super.
Salutations.
Okay, so we got a great show ahead for you guys. We're going to do the whole 2 hours together, and we're all going to take turns presenting stories for you guys. Later, I'm going to present a story of tremendous good news for you all. I will also show you videos of you. So we had submissions from IMTYT. I love it. I'm going to show that to you guys later. Nomi's got stories on the DNC. God, we got so many stories. One of my favorites is in the second hour, whatever hour it is, doesn't really matter, is that we finally have a poll on Bernie Sanders.
No.
Okay, now, hold, I don't want to give it away. Did he wind up being slightly more popular than Hillary Clinton?
Dun, dun, dun.
I wonder.
I have a hunch.
You're such a Rachel Maddow right now.
I know.
Don't give it away.
Okay, we're going to talk for a half an hour first. Actually, we'll probably talk for longer first before we get to that story. Anyway, but look, I think it ends the debate. Let me put it that way. Debate ended tonight. Okay, so don't miss that one. That one is awesome. The first story about the budget is, of course, amazing and disastrous. And it turns out, speaking of disastrous, the Americans, the Russians, the Syrians, the Kurds, and soon the Turks will all be in the same Syrian city.
They're there
okay.
Right now.
The Turks have not yet arrived, from what I understand.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay, but
Cenk's flight is tonight. Cenk's flight is tonight. Most of them.
But I hear they're the ones who knock. So I don't know, but it could be a holy hell, maybe literally in some ways. Okay. So we're all atheists, not really, but still, not literal. Anyways, okay, lots of giant stories for you guys. Jordan's got the first one.
President Trump is out with his budget, and it's probably more awful than we even expected. He takes a machete to programs for the poor, the elderly, and bloats the military even further. Let's look at the particulars here. Programs to mitigate climate change are cut or eliminated across the government. Programs to assist the poor are slashed, and while almost every department would face large cuts, three would see sizable increases in spending: defense, homeland security, and veterans affairs. Trump wants to fund a border wall, deportation raids, a hiring spree for Border Patrol, and immigration and customs enforcement, and purchase our new F-35 fighter jets and a variety of Navy vessels. And it would dramatically hamper enforcement of environmental and labor regulations and grant and loan programs for clean energy and disadvantaged regions, and significantly reduce funding for biomedical research. The EPA will be cut by 31%. From $8.2 billion down to $5.7 billion, the lowest level after adjusting for inflation in 40 years, and below where even congressional Republicans wanted it. Specifically, the budget discontinues funding for the Clean Power Plan, international climate change programs, climate change research and partnership programs and related efforts, and reduces Superfund cleanup funding. In addition, a 28% cut in the State Department budget, with particularly harsh cuts to the U.S. Agency for International Development, the Global Climate Change Initiative, and UN climate change programs would see funding cut off.
Okay, let us begin to dissect the disaster that is this budget. We haven't even gotten to all the different cuts yet. Jordan's going to read that more for you in a second, let alone the fact that here I'll skip to some pretty significant ones here. Corporation Republic Broadcasting. Oh, nice to know you. Gone. Not cut a little bit. Gone. Terminated. Okay. National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities.
Gone.
Terminated. Gone. Bye-bye. So now look, a lot of people are going to look at this budget and go, yeah, this is what I voted for. I don't like arts. I don't like public anything. I don't like science. And so the barbarians were at the gate. Now we're inside the building. So ha-ha. So I mean, look at some of the things that Jordan already alluded to. We're going to significantly reduce biomedical research. You really sure that's a good idea?
Right.
And if you're a Republican who like your tax cuts and stuff, but you say, "No, hey, Cenk, when you guys say on the Young Turks, we're against science, that's not fair." Really? Okay, you cut biomedical research. You also cut $6 billion from the National Institute for Health budget. That's 18% of their budget. Again, these are things that affect our health and safety. Okay, and also $900 million cut to the Energy's Department of Office of Science. Okay, that's another science program you're attacking. A $250 million cut to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for Research and Education, gone. And eliminating the Advanced Research Projects Agency, Energy. Okay, so you're doing research, you're doing science, they're coming for you. And so don't pretend that you're for science, because if you voted for this, you're against science, you're against research. The proof's in the pudding. That's the budget that now you should be proud of, because you put this guy in office. Okay, now if you say, look, I'm with the oil companies, or I'm an ignoramus and I can't, you know, figure out that 97% of the world's scientists are right and climate change is happening and it's man-made, etc. And I'm happy that he's cutting the EPA as it relates to climate change, or he's cutting the State Department as it relates to climate change. I hear you, but you really wanted him also to cut biomedical research and all the other scientific branches and the National Institute for Health? I mean, the guy says he's going to cut it so that he can add to the Defense Department $54 billion to keep us safe. How safe are we? I mean, right. The Muslim ban that he did, I'm sorry, travel ban, from six countries. Those countries have had zero fatal attacks inside the United States. So it is, and even all foreign-born Muslims in a five-year period have had only 5% of all the terrorist attacks in America. So we're talking about a tiny problem. But then you talk about cutting money for spending in healthcare and research and protecting us from diseases. That could affect so many more people. How safe are you? It's not a matter of making you safe. It's a matter of doing political demagoguery.
Well, the most dangerous part of it is the EPA already, it doesn't have enough money for water testing. You know, I've been to Flint, I've been to East Chicago, you've been to Chicago. Reuters recently came out with that story of over 3,000 cities with worse numbers than Flint. So he's taking a machete to an outlet that already doesn't have enough funding. And frankly, as I've shown you on youtube.com/TYTpolitics, they kind of cherry pick the way they test also for financial reasons. So he's taking a machete to the EPA. The other thing is, I don't want to hear that we don't have enough money for public college, free public college tuition. Defense spending is $54 billion, and he's also adding
more,
in some
more.
It's more than
$693 billion.
Right. Not pie in the sky. $70 billion from a socialist from Vermont, pie in the sky, radical, and communist.
Mm-hmm. What I think is really fascinating about this from a holistic perspective is it seems like Donald Trump, whatever his intentions are, it's to make this country weaker, and they're using the business argument because those forces aligned, at least in the short term, benefit from it. But in the long term, when you cut programs like legal services, which provides funding for legal aid groups, you know, that's totally eliminated. When you cut, they don't cut education, this is my favorite, because you know what they do? They put $1.4 billion into new school choice programs. So it's like they're ripping apart our country, the social programs that keep us alive, while simultaneously making money. I don't think this is just a business thing anymore. This is actually about making our country weak, because they're isolating us. They're cutting some defense programs. The State Department has massive cuts, which means that they're not going to be able to stabilize countries, which I think a lot of Republicans do believe in. And we're going to talk about that later with John McCain and Rand Paul. So it doesn't seem like business as usual for Republicans. It seems like business as usual for some corporate interests who are looking for short-term benefits. And dare I even say, and I know we're going to get a debate, perhaps there's some other motive with those who have vested interest in keeping America isolated from the rest of the world.
Okay, so before Russia. We get to that, before we get to Russia, which is fun, let me just quickly note something that Naomi said about the Department of Education. So they are adding $1.4 billion, but only to the private school program. Okay, but they are cutting before school programs, after school programs, summer programs, $2.4 billion from teacher professional development programs. So overall, you're losing money in the education department. Teachers, you get a huge cut. Private schools get an addition. And my favorite, need-based grants that help with college tuition. So your kid's really bright, and he got into a school, and he's doing great, and he's trying to live the American dream, and he's about to get a grant because he's not wasn't born as rich as Donald Trump. Sorry, we cut that program because the private schools are, you know, we got people like Betsy DeVos, who's now the education secretary, who's a giant donor to the Republican Party, who likes private schools. So this is not an America First program. This is a corporation's first program. Every corporate wish is on this here, and including Internal Revenue Service gets cut $239 million.
Unbelievable.
That's not just that that doesn't save you any money at all. That costs the American government a tremendous amount of money, because every dollar you cut from IRS, you cost yourself money that you would have gotten by catching tax cheats, but they're funded by tax cheats. Mm-hmm. So that's why they're cutting the IRS. Go ahead, Mike.
And there's another contradiction here that I think is worth thinking about. Remember, Trump's success in the Republican primary last year demonstrated that ordinary GOP voters are not particularly concerned about deficit spending, because Trump was proposing all kinds of new government programs and protecting other government programs, as well as massive tax cuts, which obviously is going to balloon the deficit. Yet a lot of these cuts now that we're seeing to basic social services programs are done on the grounds of we need to offset the spending that we're applying to the military with cuts in other areas. So this seems to be just jettisoning the message of part of the last campaign, which is that, you know, ordinary Republican voters, and, you know, who are central to Trump's electoral base, don't tend to care about deficit spending, and yet deficit spending is guiding a lot of what we're seeing here in the budget outline.
And another contradiction is he's been bitching about, oh, we've spent $6 trillion overseas and all of this bloating, and we need to focus on America first. And then he blows it up with another, how much was it? Not $54 billion.
On top of the $639 billion.
Right. Yeah.
But the thing is, a lot of that defense spending will be spent domestically. So that'll be utilized by defense contractors, Boeing, all these other kinds of
companies. Can't forget our friends, yeah.
So it's not all necessarily going to take place overseas. It's going to be domestic, and Trump has sort of advocated from the beginning. He always wanted to balloon defense spending.
And it's border patrol stuff. I mean, that's not even traditional defense spending. Right. The border is already the most funded it's ever been. We already have. It's not that we have a wall. We have a gate, we have a fence, and we have this other sort of in-between thing covering most of the border, except for areas that are very hard to cover. So he's going to put billions of dollars into this wall, more border patrol that is our, and they've got drones covering the area. I mean, I've surveyed that area so many times. I don't understand how you could fund that more.
But Mexico's going to repay us.
Oh, that's it, right?
Come on.
So let's talk about cuts to other departments. You could go to graphic 15A. 21% to agriculture and labor, gone. 18% to health and human services. Who needs health or human services? 16% to commerce. These are all cuts. 14% to education. So you see it right there. It's, even though they added to private schools, they cut education overall by 14%. If you don't consider the private schools, that's a much bigger cut to education. 13% to housing and urban development. 13% to transportation. 12% to interior. The education department would also get a, and then we explained the rest of the education department. Okay, so when you look at the transportation department, they cut that by $500 million. Wait a minute, I thought we were going to get $1 trillion in infrastructure spending. No. That's for the corporations who are going to build the highways, and that's okay. We don't have to put it in the budget because they're going to privatize the roads and make you pay tolls for the rest of your life. So when it comes to the actual transportation budget, they're actually cutting it. So opposite of what they promised you. Mm-hmm. So that's where we get into a mixed bag here. So some of this is not what Trump voters bargained for. And in fact, I think Michael is so right. I don't think that Trump voters, Republican voters overall, care about the deficit. I don't think they've ever cared about the deficit.
It's always been an elite concern within the party.
Yeah, and part of the reason that they do that, talk about caring about the deficit, is because they want to cut Social Security, Medicare, et cetera, so they can lower taxes on the rich. That's why the elites care about it. But actual voters almost don't care about it at all. So he actually cut too much, because some of his own voters were like, I mean, wait, you cut $6 billion from the National Institute of Health?
Yeah.
No, I don't know that that's a good idea, right? And some of them like PBS and NPR, and some of them will like the arts, whatever. Maybe not many, but some of them do. He probably cut too deep in that sense. On the other hand, look, he told you he was going to devastate, spending in the country, and then he was going to do massive cuts, that he was going to nearly destroy the EPA, and he's doing what he said he was going to do. So don't get surprised that he's destroying the EPA. They probably, they love oil, coal, gas, and he handed the State Department to ExxonMobil's CEO. So the State Department initiatives that go towards cleaning up the environment and making sure we fight climate change, they're completely eliminated. Of course, the CEO of ExxonMobil is the head of the State Department. They're not going to spend a dime on climate change. So don't get surprised. A lot of this is exactly what Trump promised you.
Another thing having to do with the State Department cuts is, I think it's a little difficult to defend State Department spending on the merits because of all the misguided foreign adventures that the State Department has been complicit in over the years. So maybe it's bad in the long run to have imposed these cuts on the State Department. But at the same time, Democrats are a little hamstrung in arguing affirmatively why those cuts should not have been done, because what's the track record? I mean, the State Department
that were cut, like USAID, AID, they hand out food distribution. I mean, that's actually a really successful model.
But they've also done propaganda in the past, so it's just a mixed bag.
Okay, so let me.
Who doesn't do propaganda?
Yeah. Okay, and so let me just say this about that, because Michael, if it was removed from the context, you might have an interesting point there. But let me disagree with you because of where they cut. Mm-hmm. So within the State Department, they didn't cut on interventionist stuff. If they wanted to be less interventionist, they wouldn't add $54 billion to the Defense Department. So what they're, and they're bragging, Mulvaney, who runs the Office of Management and Budget today, bragging about, this is not a soft power budget. This is a hard power budget, meaning we're spending on the military and we're not interested in winning over our hearts and minds, etc. Now, let's note, as I always do for the record, that the most successful foreign policy program the US or almost anyone in the world has ever had was the Marshall Plan. Soft power, where actually we rebuilt our enemies into our allies. Mm-hmm. I mean, stunningly, epically successful program. These guys are bragging about how we don't do that kind of crap that works. I thought these guys were against war, and all they've done is add to the war machine. And so what part of the State Department did they cut? They cut international assistance, they cut all the things that gain us goodwill in the world and that are not part of war. So one of the things they cut is a poverty program that you can't know for 100% sure, but according to the analyst, helped to save 2 million lives. That earns you a lot of good. Why do you think anybody even still likes America in the world? I mean, for all you see on TV, all you see is the wars and wars. But behind the scenes, and I even gave credit to Bush here, because he actually did pretty good work in Africa. That was one of the few things he did right. We actually do a lot of help and assistance. It doesn't cost us that much, because even one of the program that saves 2 million lives is barely $1 billion, whereas you're adding $54 billion to the war machine in this budget. So don't believe the hype about how Trump is not interventionist or pro-war. We'll have to see on that. But right now, his spending priorities say, yay, war.
Now, my only point was that given the overall blemished record of the State Department in the recent past, it makes it more difficult to mount an effective public defense of aspects of the State Department portfolio that actually are beneficial.
Right. Well, that's our job to talk about what has been beneficial. And they've been winning their messaging fight and pointing out all that is bad. And of course, Hillary Clinton is attached to a lot of their messaging on that. And so it is the progressive fight to say, well, there's still a need for a State Department. There's still a need to have the Peace Corps. I mean, these are things that, as you said, that we have a long history of success in, but it's our job to message that. Is this even going to get passed, though? I mean, do you see Republicans passing this? It's not looking like it.
So that's a great question. So right now, some of the Republicans, because they kind of actually intuitively, because they've been running for office a lot longer than Trump in the House and the Senate, intuitively know that the voters don't actually care about the deficits. That's just propaganda, so they can do tax cuts. So Mitch McConnell's like, I don't want to really cut the State Department. And he might have reasons involving local politics or donors, etc. But and the budgets proposed by presidents don't pass. That's not what happens. It's Congress's job to do a budget. The president offers his suggestion. So, for example, I think it was in 2015, Obama offered a suggestion, and his budget was voted upon, and it was voted down, but only 98-1. Right. So, and it's not because it was a horrific budget; it's because they don't do the president's budget, but they do look at it for guidance. Mm-hmm. So, this is Trump saying, "This is what I would like." And remember, if he doesn't get what he likes from his Republican allies, He will viciously attack them. Right. So Obama's budgets were far more suggestions. Trump's are, I better see you with your red hat on when we're voting on this.
So moving on. So the usual suspects are out defending President Trump's budget, including his Secretary of State and budget director. We'll start with Rex Tillerson, who on State Department cuts says, clearly the level of spending that the State Department has been undertaking, particularly in this past year, is simply not sustainable. As time goes by, there will be fewer military conflicts that the U.S. will be directly engaged in. He went on to say, I'm confident that with the input of the men and women of the State Department, we are going to construct a way forward that allows us to be much more effective, much more efficient, and be able to do a lot with fewer dollars, which means nothing. And let's also show the director of Management and Budget Office, Mick Mulvaney, who was on Morning Joe, offering a nice little spin to this story.
$54 billion more to defense, a big military buildup,
yeah,
and cuts to programs that affect a lot of people in this country, including the Department of Education, the EPA, and the environment. How do you defend that?
You could put those graphs back on the screen if you wanted to, and I could point to you speeches that the president gave during the campaign that said exactly those things. In fact, that's how we wrote the budget. We went back and pulled lines out of speeches, out of interviews, talked to the president, and turned his words, his policies, into numbers. So folks who voted for the president are getting exactly what they voted for.
We're peeling away after school programs. We're hitting public schools. I know some of that money is being diverted into charter schools and to school choice. But do you see why people would be upset by that? Do we need another F-35 and not have after school programs?
Don't get me wrong. There's waste in the Defense Department as well. But when you start talking about priorities, okay, the president's priorities were national defense, homeland security, taking care of veterans, school choice, and that's what we have. When you start looking at the places that will reduce spending, one of the questions we asked was, can we really continue to ask a coal miner in West Virginia or a single mom in Detroit to pay for these programs? The answer was no. We can ask them to pay for defense, and we will. Make no mistake about it. This is a hard power budget, not a soft power budget. That is what the president wanted, and that's what we gave him.
Lord.
So let me get this right. We can't afford to ask people to pay for their kids' education, like an after-school program. That was the literal example that was given right to his face. No, we can't expect coal miners to pay for their kids' education. But a giant multi-billion dollar contract to Lockheed Martin, well, of course we're gonna make coal miners pay for that.
But also, we can't expect that, but we could expect low-income people, the former middle class of America, to pay for your wealthy donors' tax cuts, because somebody's paying for them. And then you also add in, when Trump's not adding all this money to defense just to, you know, sit there still, who's going to pay for the wars he eventually goes to? We know what happened under Bush. Deep tax cuts, wars on the credit card, years later, not directly connected, but a financial crash. We've done this before, and we know the results.
And the lives.
Right.
Whether, I mean, now that you don't have all these other programs, because at least we had some of these programs under Bush. You know, when a coal miner gets cancer, how are they going to cover that? When you don't have research and development for the PTSD, for those vets that come back and need assistance, what are they going to do? I mean, we already have a problem. We're not out of 2008 yet. We are still deep in. And I respect Obama in a lot of ways, but for him to take credit for rebounding this country, the middle class does not exist anymore, and we're going to slash it even more. Like, how do we rebound after that? How do we rebound after the next 4 years?
Yeah, well, I don't know, man. If these priorities that are in this budget actually get instituted and take effect for 4 years, that is going to be a hole that is going to be so hard to climb out of.
Tom Perez will save us.
Well, that's what I was about to say, because, you know, yes, this is from Trump, but the Democratic Party should be out going the extreme opposite way. Yep. We need single payer. We need free public college tuition. Yep. What are they doing? Trump's evil. We need to take down Trump. Donate. The DNC email is coming tonight, folks. I will report and update you. So, yes, this is coming from Trump, but the Democratic Party doesn't have an alternative. We'll get to, you know, Bernie a little bit later. But Trump is obviously the culprit behind this and his donors. But what are the Democratic Party putting forward?
It's interesting you say that, because I'm on their messaging list, and as I'm sure you are, too. And they send out massive blasts every day to the press of what we should cover. And they attach articles. And it is all about Trump being a racist, the Muslim ban, Russia, nothing else. They don't talk about the economy. They don't talk about school choice, which we'll talk about later because they're invested in it. They don't talk about the budget. They're not even talking about the budget today. None of those emails they sent today were about the budget.
And that's the thing. Like, Democrats have a role to play in crafting the budget, theoretically. It's not outside their purview to be involved in how this thing is crafted. We all know that Trump is not an ideological conservative. So if he perceives some political advantage in maybe modifying something here and including something that's important to Democrats, you could conceivably see him capitulating under certain circumstances. And yet, it seems like Democrats are just willing to forego any semblance of that and just defer to Trump and the Republicans in managing this process, which is unfortunate.
And who at this table actually thinks Trump read this budget or wrote anything in the budget? He only asked for one pagers with bullets.
It came from his speeches.
No, but that's actually why I think Mulvaney mentioned the speeches.
Right.
Because they didn't actually confer with him on the specifics. Look, even on the intelligence briefings he's supposed to get every day, most important thing, he says keep it to one page, and he likes graphs and maps. So you think he read this giant budget? No, so their way of saying we conferred with him is we conferred with the Trump of Ghost Past, you know, and so we looked at the campaign footage and said, I think that's what he wants.
I just love the idea of Mick Mulvaney sitting on YouTube and like going back and watching old speeches and like pulling his hair out and trying to see how he can translate that into a budget proposal. It's pretty funny.
But also, even that is not true. I must have gone to at least 15 to 30 Trump rallies, and I'm still recovering. And let me tell you something. He did not specify, I'm going to cut the EPA by 30%. He just talked in broad strokes. So, you know, yes, they could say, we're doing what we said we were going to do. But he was not stipulating to, you know, what Steve Bannon said, we're going to, you know, get rid of the administrative state. I mean, the voters probably wouldn't have cared anyway if he said that. But he did not go in depth about these. I want to also get to another aspect of this, our favorite climate change denier, James Inhofe. He responded to President Trump's budget.
$1.6 billion cut away from the EPA. That's what the president wants. This is the agency that, as you know, regulates a lot of things in this country, including protecting clean water, protecting against things like what happened in Flint, Michigan. Are you comfortable with this cut? Is this a good cut for the American people?
Oh, yeah, it's a good cut for the American people. You got to keep in mind now, all these functions that they're supposed to be performing in terms of the Clean Air, the Clean Air Act, it's the nature, Poppy, of a bureaucracy. If you cut their budget, then they're going to try to take the things that are popular back home and cut those. Well, I would be concerned about that, except now we have a different budget director of the EPA. He'll figure out a way to do it. We want to deliver the services. We're going to make things clean. But we're going to take the all this stuff that comes out of the EPA that's brainwashing our kids, that is propaganda, things that aren't true, allegations.
In defending Scott Pruitt, who is overseeing the internal implosion of the EPA, he said later, I know this guy, I know him well. Is that a compliment or a criticism? But the reason that he frames it that way is because in Washington circles, policy never matters. Are you polite to the people around you in the cocktail circuit matters? So that's Inhofe saying, hey, you've seen me. We've had martinis together. And I'm vouching for Pruitt. I know him. I know him well. If I know him, that's good enough. Mm-hmm. So let's go slash all those budgets and pour toxic sludge into your local rivers and stuff. It's not your local river in Washington, right? It's a local river in North Dakota or Arkansas or whatever.
But he's not just an idiot. He also has been in the Senate in office for a while because he gets a lot of cash from the energy and oil industries. So people like him, yes, they're ignorant and stupid, but they're also taking in huge hordes of cash from the same people that they are saying are, working against the brainwashing, as he calls it. So it's idiocy, ignorance, and greed all in one.
Sounds great.
Yes.
Of all the departments of the government to be concerned about in terms of the propaganda that it puts forward, the EPA seems like a misguided one to fixate on, but we wouldn't really expect anything else from Senator Inhofe.
Yeah, I mean, look, no, the Defense Department, they don't do any propaganda.
No.
God forbid we should talk about that. But the EPA, with all that propaganda about how we need clean air and clean water, you got to really watch out for that.
Who needs to clean up a Superfund site?
Right.
Yeah, no, that's one of the cuts. I mean,
East Chicago.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Norman, because Superfund sites are literally disastrous, right? They're literally toxic. If you got a Superfund site around you and he just said, I'm not going to ever clean it up, if you know anything of what's going on, you got to be furious about that. He says, no, I'm doing it to protect you. You know, we need that. We need another couple of aircraft carriers and more F-35s to protect you from terrorists who sometimes take over planes with, just
wire cutters.
Exactly. And even the terrorists who do the attacks and stuff like that. How's an F-35 like the San Bernardino? Right, guy goes in and shoots up his office space. How's an F-35 going to help you with that? Mm-hmm. The F-35 helps Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, those guys who are giant donors. But meanwhile, the Superfund site is right next to you. There's a Great Lakes restoration project. Mm-hmm. They're going to cut it, and this is an amazing comical cut. Its budget is $300 million. They're going to cut it to just $10 million. They're taking away $290 million. Now, I didn't know this, and this is amazing. I feel bad I didn't know it, that it turns out that is 84% of North America's surface fresh water supply.
Yep.
We might want to protect that. That seems like a pretty big deal. In fact, for the whole world's supply of surface fresh water, it's 21% of the whole world's surface fresh water. Like, protect that? No. We got to build more weapons. I mean, it's almost as if they took Eisenhower's quote and flipped it on his head, right? Yeah. For every child of yours that we educate or protect, for every air we clean and every water we clean, we can't afford another aircraft carrier. Right. Come on. Right.
But really, another element here is this is really big oil's last stand. And President Trump knows that. Inhofe knows that. That's what I saw at Dakota Access Pipeline. They are taking extreme measures by cutting the EPA this far, by basically paying off the police to brutalize environmentalists and Native Americans, because the numbers are the numbers. Wind and solar are getting bigger and bigger. They're also rivaling jobs to the oil and gas industry, as
we've seen recently. But they're cutting those tax benefits for them as well.
Right.
To go back to there's an interesting aspect to this Great Lakes region. There's a congressman named Chris Collins. He's from Buffalo, outside of Buffalo. He was the first congressman to endorse Donald Trump. And he is somebody who is actively, this is somebody who says he's going to turn around Buffalo. He's been campaigning on this propaganda. And now he is actively working with Donald Trump to make sure that that region, which has a lot of Superfund sites also, is devastated because they're not investing in the Great Lakes region anymore. Bring back those jobs.
By the way, it affects 8 states near the Great Lakes. I don't know if you know any American geography, but those are pretty critical states that Trump won. So this is what I meant earlier in the live show when we were talking about how he didn't have to cut this much because his own voters don't actually care about the deficit. So you're going to cut the Great Lakes protection near Michigan and Wisconsin. That seems like a pretty bad political idea, but they can't help themselves. They're like, no, we will not protect the water. The only thing that matters is oil. Okay. All right. We got to take a quick break. Okay. So we got a lot more stories for you. Just did 2 right there. I still have the good news. We haven't gotten to the good news yet. And luckily, we avoided a Russian debate. Okay. So we'll be right back.
That's coming, though.
I threw it out there.
All right, back on the Young Turks. power panel for you guys. Kitty Napper says, okay, cut it out. Kitty Napper says, TYT Army's donations made this awesome power panel possible. Be proud of yourselves, everyone. I couldn't agree more. Yeah. Well, Jordan comes from tytnetwork.com/join, because your subscriptions powered our ability to hire Jordan. And then Nomi and Michael are from tytnetwork.com/go. So let's check in on that real quick. $127 from Melissa in Illinois, and $127 from Vanessa in California. If you guys want, if you donate to $127, you get that shirt, the Trump as the Night King. Freak out your friends, families, and neighbors by wearing it around. Mm-hmm. It says the night is dark and full of tweets. We actually have a poll on his tweets later in the program, so you guys will enjoy that. We'll pull that up as soon as we can for you guys. We're super close. There it is.
Whoa.
Wow.
1.456. Guys, we're only 44 away from, almost 45 away from, no bad math, 43 away almost from 1.5. So if you guys keep this up next week, we're gonna have to announce new people, and look, as we get closer, we make those decisions thinking that we'll probably get there, right? Mm-hmm. And can I get agreement without saying who it is that the next set of hires are a little exciting?
Yes, very exciting.
Yes,
I can't.
I am in agreement with that statement.
Huge. Let's come on. Let's do it. Let's do it right now. Let's get to 1.5.
Come on.
TYT Network.
Don't go for drinks tonight. Forget drinks. Stay at home and watch us, and just put all of your drinking money into TYT.
Sell your precious belongings and donate the money to TYT.
Don't
pay your taxes.
Well, actually, now you know you won't get caught.
Trump's eliminating the IRS.
IRS.
We told you earlier they cut the IRS. Anyway, don't do anything bad, okay? Just if you have it, please, okay?
I do not endorse any of my statements.
Okay. Joshua Fisher writes, and it's funny how 80 plus years of progress from FDR to now can just be washed down the toilet by one angry orange moron. I am Sock writes in, I think you're forgetting how effective tanks and aircraft carriers are at fighting cancer.
Yes.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. And then Jessica Allison would like to open up a can of worms by saying, gee, I wonder who in the world would benefit from a much weakened U.S. Okay, leave it
Thank
alone.
You.
Leave it
Thank
alone.
You, Jessica.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, please. All right, I'll read one last one. Yeah, Peter Giel writes in, at what point does Spock relieve Kirk of command here? Criminal stupidity, greed, and indifference to citizens. Not this point, because he told you, look, again, Jordan's right. He didn't tell you all the specifics of 31% from the EPA and 28% from the State Department. And by the way, your great legs are fucked. He didn't say that stuff, okay? But he did tell you that he was going to be draconian and he was pro defense and against everything else. And by the way, he also hit the poor. We didn't even get to that part of the story. Mm-hmm. So, no, you can't relieve someone of command for kind of doing what his voters kind of wanted. So, if he breaks the law, that's a different story, which of course brings us back to Russia. Okay, all right. Okay, so let's give you good news. Okay, we have excellent news for you guys from the state of New Mexico and Wolfpack, but we're not done yet. We're gonna need your help. There's only 2 days left, so it is in fact panic time. First, let me give you the good news. Democracy's alive at the state level. So yet another bipartisan vote. First, let me tell you how you can help. Go Allison at wolf-pack.com. If you're in the state of New Mexico, you need to email her right now. They're in the middle of the fight and they need to pass the House. And if they do, it becomes state number 6. Wait a minute, don't you have to pass the Senate first? Wrong, we just passed it yesterday. Let me see the vote here, 27-14. It has passed the Senate. In New Mexico, Senate Joint Resolution 12, with the heroic help of the state legislators there. By the way, another bipartisan win. Both Democrats and Republicans voted for that, and all the people who voted for it should get tremendous credit, especially because in this case, the lobbyists are onto us. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the right wing, by the way, also left wing lobbyists coming around saying, how dare you? I'll leave out the group for now. But a left-wing lobbyist group, that Allison that you're going to email to get involved in this fight, they said, oh, that's just that chick from California who's got like a religious following. What? And they're supposed to be liberals. Okay. No, you know who that quote-unquote chick from California is? She was a school teacher in Orange County. And she joined Wolfpack. She had never even heard of the Young Turks. She just wanted to get money out of politics, research what was the most logical group who had the best plan. And she's like, I'm gonna join that one. And she was such an amazing volunteer that she moved all the way up the ranks until she became one of the national directors. That's that chick from California. And it's not about it. Unlike those guys, we don't have cults of personality. This is over 35,000 volunteers. So, by the way, why did it pass the Senate? Despite all those lobbyists that are against it, not only the great work of those legislators, but you know what influenced them? You guys did. Every time there was a committee hearing, it'd be 50 Wolfpack volunteers, wow, all from New Mexico, all from their districts, and they're like, what is this? We've never seen anything like this in a subcommittee hearing or a committee hearing, let alone the floor vote. So that's why we need your help right now. So there's only 2 days left. You got to go to the House because it has to pass the Senate and the House, and then New Mexico becomes state number 6. So now, how does it work? What does it mean to be state number 6? There's two ways to amend the Constitution. This is to do election reform to get free and fair elections. That's why we get bipartisan votes, because actually Republican voters also love that. So now the two ways to do it is, one is through Congress. You think 2/3 of this corrupt Congress, that swamp, is going to say, oh yeah, yeah, go ahead, get the money out of politics that put me into office in the first place. Oh, it's rigged? It's rigged and put me in office. Why would I want to fix that system, right? So they're not going to do it at the national level, but the founding fathers were both geniuses and actual revolutionaries. They put a second way to do a revolution in the document. They said you can get an amendment through the states. You get 34 states to call for a convention. At the convention, you discuss the amendment, propose the amendment. Either way, you need 38 states to ratify the amendment. So don't believe any demagoguery on the left or the right about this. It's in our Constitution for a reason, for exactly this reason. Now, I got to show you some of the heroes here in New Mexico. Senator Ortiz E. Pino tried to explain this as well. He's our sponsor for this Senate resolution, fought for it tooth and nail, one of the new founding fathers as we get our democracy back. Watch.
Wow.
House Senate Joint Resolution 12 is a free and fair elections resolution, and it calls for an amendment to our U.S. Constitution that will restore free and fair elections in America. Since Congress is incapable of solving, it seems these days, any problem, the resolution calls for a limited Article 5 amendment convention to propose an amendment that would deal with the influence of money in our elections. Most amendments to the Constitution start this way. The states begin calling for a convention, and eventually Congress gets the message and makes the amendment themselves, proposes the amendment themselves.
So he's explaining that for two important reasons. One, there's talking points, and we trace them all the way back, because some groups on the left use them too. Oh my God, a convention that would bring real change. If you're on the left, you should want real change. The good thing about the guys on the right, the actual voters, is that they like change. That's why they voted for Trump. Right? They're like, right or wrong, whatever kind of change, I get that this system is screwing us, right?
So I had a lot of Democrats. A lot of Democrats voted for Trump.
And because they're desperate for change. Mm-hmm. But the elites hate change. That's why they hate the convention. They're like, convention, that's real change. Don't do that. And we trace back the talking points to about runaway conventions. You know who originally came up with them? The John Birch Society. Hmm. The same guys who think there's fluoride in the water, some communist plot or whatever, and Eisenhower was a communist. Those wackos came up with talking points that groups on the right and left are using today about, oh, conventions, that would bring real change, don't do it.
And guys like Mark Levin have been pushing this notion of a constitutional convention for a long time. So even if you don't agree as to what the outcome of the convention would be, you can at least get them on board in terms of the principle of holding them in the first place.
So see, that's exactly what the elites hate, because right and left can come together. And you don't have to agree on what the convention should be. You can only have a convention on one topic at a time. So if Levin wants to have it on whatever conservative cause he wants to have it on, that's when liberals freak out. They're like, wait, they get to use democracy too?
Right.
Yeah, they also get to vote. That's how democracy works. But guess what? And their solution, some of the groups on the left, is no, we should unilaterally disarm. We shouldn't use the convention at all. No, it's in the Constitution. Use it. It's a real agent of change. So, and then he's explaining again. Look, We got you got to get to 34 states. And in fact, I've got another congressman, senator who's going to talk about it in a second. First, let me go to Senate Majority Leader Peter Wirth. Without him, there's no way this thing would have passed. So bless his heart, he gives another argument.
And it really has changed the landscape so dramatically that I have grave concerns for our democratic process moving forward, given these huge amounts of unlimited money that are in the system. So, you know, this is a way for the people to express their frustrations and their concern by coming and pushing something like this. And I can't give enough kudos to all of the young people who have gotten involved in this issue, who care and are looking at our future. And so I have certainly listened to them.
So, look, we want to bring democracy back, and you do that by getting the corrupting influence of money out. But I also want you to remember that democracy exists at the state level. So seeing politicians actually stand up for you is kind of an amazing sight. You know, we're used to the somewhat older, middle-aged politicians who get up and tell you, no, the oil companies are great, and the defense contractors are great, and your kid doesn't need an education, right? Mm-hmm. And here are politicians who actually give a damn and who are responsive, who see all these Wolfpack and other citizens who are saying, no, I want free and fair elections, and I'm from across the political spectrum. And they recognize it, and they fight for you. It's amazing.
And some of that is because it is, not in all cases, but it is cheaper to run for office in these states. And they see how money is starting to trickle in. You know, it used to be just California and New York and big cities and metropolitan areas, but now it's starting to trickle into rural communities, and they're like, we don't want, you know, to have to dial for dollars 80% of the time in our rural community. It changes the format of how politics works at the state level. And my frustration is that it's not just that the establishment doesn't want this convention for the sake of hearing the opposition. It's that they want to stifle ideas. Mm. When you don't put two sides, the opposing sides, at the same table to talk things out, then guess what? Those centrists in the center, suddenly their ideas get pushed out because it's really obvious where the right ideas are, the proper ideas are.
And Bernie Sanders just showed. I mean, they saw what happened during the presidential election. Bernie Sanders was outpacing Hillary Clinton for several months with small dollar donations. So they see that the big money machine doesn't necessarily equate to getting you in office or keeping you in office.
Yeah, and so on Nomi's point, there's a lot of Republicans who vote for this legislation across the country because they're like, wait, I don't want Rove coming in here and telling me what to do at the state level. I certainly don't want Bloomberg coming in here and telling me what to do. So this doesn't really help me at all. It helps the national guys who have money from these donors by the millions and overall by the billions. And when he said the first speaker there, Pino, said that most amendments actually happen by calling for a convention. I don't know if you know that. A lot of people don't know it. It's that the threat of the convention scares the bejesus out of Congress. And more than half of our amendments have been passed because of a threat of a convention. So they're like, it'll get to a point where they're about to have the convention, and even for the direct election of senators. None of the senators were elected through direct election. And then you have the convention threat, and they're like, yeah, we meant direct election. Of course, that's what we meant, right? So keep on going. Let's do one more here. This is Senator Ivy Soto.
If somebody is concerned on the right as to how many blue states might try to manipulate our Constitution, if somebody's concerned on the left as to how many red states might try to manipulate our Constitution, in this last election, 30 states voted for Trump and 20 states voted for Clinton, and it takes 38 states to amend our Constitution. So not only, Mr. President and colleagues, would we become number 6 of a goal of getting to 34 unless Congress takes action before that, the ratification would require both blue states and red states of anything that came out of there. And if what came out of there was not thoughtful and balanced, it would not get ratified. And so I feel, as someone who loves our country and loves our Constitution and believes it is a wonderful document that is very forward looking, I feel comfortable supporting this. Because supporting this, what we're doing today is we're saying, Congress, hey, pay attention. Listen to us. There's an issue here.
Yeah, absolutely. And so he makes two great points. One you just heard right there, which is, Look, all the fear mongering on the left and the right about change. Oh my God, what if they say the aliens should take over and we should shred the Constitution and just hand it over to the lizard people? How are you going to get 38 states to ratify that? 38 states are not going to ratify anything like that. You need something that all the American people agree with. By the way, there's only one thing the entire American people agree with. Well, to be fair, also Social Security. Protecting Social Security and Medicare and election reform. It's a disaster. And the guys who say, oh, you'll have this convention filled with all these different topics. No, it has to be one at a time. You know how many convention calls there's been? 700. Wow. But they're on different topics, so that's why we've never had a convention. You need 34 on one topic. New Mexico can be number 6 on this one topic of election reform, but it's in the vote in the House is in 2 days. So you got to go right now. If you're in New Mexico, Allison@wolf-pack.com, get in the fight. You swing these representatives more than you can imagine. So let's go get them. Allison@wolf-pack.com. Make it happen right now. Okay. That's my two cents. Let's go to Michael.
Okay, so last night, the latest iteration of the Trump purported travel ban was set to go in effect at midnight, but it was enjoined temporarily by the federal district court judge in Hawaii. And I think it's worth digging into the contents of the order that was issued because it gives some insights as to how this might play out going forward legally. So first, in order to establish that a claimant has standing to assert that they've been harmed by this order, they have to establish standing. And the state of Hawaii is one of the entities that sued here. So they argued that the university recruits students, the University of Hawaii, that is, recruits students, permanent faculty, and visiting faculty from the targeted countries, meaning the 6 countries that are targeted by the order. And students or faculty are suspended from entry, are deterred from studying or teaching at the university now and in the future, irrevocably damaging their personal and professional lives and harming the educational institutions themselves. So the argument that underlies this order that was issued is that the University of Hawaii system has been victimized by the order. The order then goes on. It currently has 23 graduate students, several permanent faculty members, and 29 visiting faculty members from the 6 countries listed. The state contends that any prospective recruits who are without visas as of March 16th, 2017, will not be able to travel to Hawaii to attend the university. As a result, the university will not be able to collect the tuition that those students would have paid. So one of the arguments here is that the state of Hawaii is actually incurring a financial loss as a result of the order because they're not being not able to take in future tuition payments from people who might have attended who hail from these particular countries.
So let me jump in there real quick, because what they're trying to do is they usually weigh both sides of an argument. So the government says, hey, look, we have a lot to gain from doing this travel ban. We're going to protect the country, et cetera. And it doesn't burden the state of Hawaii too much because we're just keeping out the bad guys. So the reason that they're mentioning how much the state of Hawaii is burdened is to show, no, this has actual real ramifications on the people of Hawaii, the state of Hawaii. So the government, the national government is not correct on that, and the judge is agreeing with that portion.
And this is really important because the judge writes that these types of injuries, the ones that are described by the state of Hawaii in their claim, are nearly indistinguishable from those found to support standing in the Ninth Circuit's decision in Washington. So remember, the previous version of the travel ban was struck down by a federal court judge in the state of Washington, and it was struck down on almost indistinguishable grounds as were the reasons why this particular version was struck down. So although the Trump administration tried to modify the language of this version of the ban, the underlying reasons why it was found to cause unjustified harm are still there, notwithstanding any adjustments they may have made.
And let me explain standing super quick. If you're not related to the case, you can't bring the case forward. It might be that the government has done terrible damage, but it hasn't done it to you. And so then you wouldn't have standing. So this is the court saying, no, it has done it to the state of Hawaii, and it did it to this particular claimant in this case as well. And that's affected by it. It's a citizen of Hawaii that helps sue. So they have standing. They've been injured. We can hear this case.
Besides the obvious moral and what's right ramifications of this. It's also encouraging to the left because it shows, I mean, they took like two weeks to redo this.
Right.
And they still can't get it right. I mean, during the campaign, when people would be hollering and screaming, I kept saying, well, half the shit he's trying to do is illegal. So, you know, not to minimize the things he's trying to do, but it just shows the incompetence because they went back to the drawing board and, you know, many, like an amateur lawyer could find loopholes in what they're trying to do.
And the excuse I love at the end, after several excuses the government went before, they were, when Judge Watson rejected the government's argument in a court that they would have to investigate Donald Trump's veiled psyche to understand whether or not this was religious animus. Like, that's how far they're going. They want to hire a psychologist to investigate what his intentions were. I mean, is that a ridiculous argument? How often is something like that brought up?
So let me explain that as well. So why do they go to, why are we talking about Donald Trump's psyche here? Because, and it goes to what Jordan said too. Look, all right, so they've got standing, and one of the plaintiffs here is an individual named Ismail El-Sheikh. He is the imam of the Muslim Association of Hawaii, which I didn't know existed, but I guess that makes sense.
Founding member was Barack Obama.
We are kidding. So we've got standing, we've got real injury here, but is the government right that this is a perfectly fine test to make sure that America is safe, or is it actually a way to keep out Muslims? And so Trump's administration is arguing, like, you're trying to figure out if Trump actually means Muslim ban when he says travel ban. So you're trying to get into his veiled psychology here. That's ridiculous. It's not a Muslim ban because we didn't say that it was a Muslim ban. We just said it was a travel ban. So you got to take us at our word. So that's when Judge Watson then responds, the person who made the ruling here. For instance, there's nothing veiled about this press release. Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. He's like, you don't have to be a pop psychologist to figure out what that means. Right. So the judge's ruling here is very important because he's saying, look, we know that Donald Trump said he wanted to target Muslims. In the first version of the bill, they said that Christians would be favored over Muslims. That's totally unconstitutional. You cannot do that. That's a religious preference that is not allowed in the United States Constitution. So now this is the second version of it. And the judge is saying, what? If you told me all over the campaign that you want a total complete shutdown of Muslims, and then you did one where you favored Christians over Muslims, let alone all the other problems that the bill had. Now you give me this bill and say, no, this one's fine. Because they did take away Christians being favored, because it's so unconstitutional. They're like, that's never going to get through court. So they took that away. And then they go, now don't read into my psychology. And the judge is saying, it's not psychology, we can all see it. You wanted a Muslim ban, this is still a Muslim ban. And by the way, it doesn't mean that this judge is going to win at the end. As I told you yesterday, at the end, you can go to a court that is conservative court or a mixed court, and they could say, well, you say tomato, I say tomato. It doesn't say they're banning just Muslims. It no longer prefers Christians over Muslims. So I'm going to say, I'm just going to read it on its face and say, I guess he thinks those six countries are really dangerous. There's no evidence to that either, but I'm going to take him at his word. That is possible. But these two judges, not just in Hawaii, but one in Maryland as well, said, we're not buying it.
And the point that, and that's exactly the point the judge was making. He was saying, you're not, it's not required that you do any kind of excessive interrogation of Trump's motives to know the motives that underlie this order, because it's normally discouraged for justices to get too in-depth into trying to discern, you know, remote psychological reasons why someone might do something. But Trump stated plainly, and this is in graphic 34, skipping ahead, he said during an October 9th, 2016 televised presidential debate, quote, the Muslim ban is something that in some form has morphed into an extreme vetting from certain areas of the world. So Trump explicitly said that this notion, which would plainly violate the establishment clause of the Constitution, banning on the basis of religion, was simply going to morph into another version with a little more neutral language that doesn't immediately present as targeting Muslims, but that's what it does in effect. And if you look at the next slide, Stephen Miller articulated exactly that during a televised interview. He said, fundamentally, despite technical revisions meant to address the Ninth Circuit's concerns in Washington, you're still going to have the same basic policy outcome. So the point is that notwithstanding any changes they might make to the legalese here, the motive has already been established based on these people's public statements. So there's nothing that they can really do to make this pass a constitutional muster, according to at least this one judge.
And so now we're going to give you Trump's video in a second and show you how badly he botched his own case after this decision, because what they're weighing here, as we've been explaining, is does the government, the Trump administration, have a legitimate grounds for this, or is it an illegitimate purpose of an unconstitutional religious test? So it doesn't help when Stephen Miller says, yeah, we're just doing the same thing as the last time when we did the religious test and we preferred Christians over Muslims. It doesn't help, and it was actually presented in court when Rudy Giuliani said on Fox News, and they showed the tape of it, Giuliani saying, hey, you wanted a total and complete shutdown of Muslims and asked me how to make it legal, so we came up with this. Like, so then the judge goes, okay, but that goes, see, I told you, it's to discriminate against Muslims. So Trump, since he's infinitely stupid, comes out. Now, if you're a smart person who wants this in place, you would come out and say, this has got nothing to do with discrimination. And oh, that first version that clearly said we prefer Christians over Muslims? No, we didn't mean that. We're doing something else entirely here, right? So did he do that? Let's go to the tape and find out.
Makes us look weak, which, by the way, we no longer are, believe me. Just look at our borders. We're going to win. We're going to keep our citizens safe. And regardless, we're going to keep our citizens safe. Believe me. Remember this. I wasn't thrilled. But the lawyers all said, oh, let's tailor it. This is a watered down version of the first one. This is a watered down version. And let me tell you something. I think we ought to go back to the first one and go all the way, which is what I wanted to do in the first place. The danger is clear, the law is clear, the need for my executive order is clear. I was elected to change our broken and dangerous system and thinking in government that has weakened and endangered our country and left our people defenseless. And I will not stop fighting for the safety of you and your families, believe me. Not today, not ever. We're going to win it. We're going to win it.
Okay, so.
And he admitted there that he acquiesced to lawyers over his judgment. So that's not really strength, is it? If he felt so strongly about the need for that initial order, why didn't he stick to his guns?
That's certainly true. But this goes to the heart of the case. Because yesterday I said he'll probably win at the end because it no longer has the religious test in the text of the law, right? But now, after I said that, he goes and gives this speech and says, no, I meant the religious test. This is just a watered down version. I prefer the first version, which is the real version. But then they're going to put that into court and you're going to lose, you knucklehead.
But that's why his stupidity might be the saving grace of all of us. Because remember, I mean, he said during the campaign so many things he was going to do illegally. He said he was going to kill people's terrorist families, yeah, too, which is very against international law. So he said all these things. So when he tries to do certain things, it's already on the record. And then, like you said, he'll go back and say, oh, we should have stuck with the first one. So, yeah, it's not just like the fact that he's politically incorrect. No, you're stupid. You don't know what you're doing, and it's coming back to bite him.
Yeah, because if you actually wanted the ban, this was wildly counterproductive.
But then there's also other areas that I find troubling, because it's not just the Muslim ban. I was listening to NPR this morning, and they were doing a story on a woman who came in from Chile who went and smoked pot in Colorado legally. They seized her phone when she left, and she worked for an American company, went through her phone, found out that she had been in Colorado and took a picture of a pot store and asked her. And she goes, yeah, it's legal there. They said, oh, federal law, you're banned from the country. So now they're finding these reasons. So it's not just this ban that's an executive order. They're weaponizing the immigration forces to find whatever reason it is to ban people. I think this is a fight that's going to be one of our darkest days in America if this continues.
You're so smart.
I'm not. I'm just saying. There's so many layers to this.
Yeah, but to be fair,
I listen to the radio.
While NPR exists.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right. To be fair, Nomi, is our folks from Shelley Brown, or are they not brown?
That's a good point.
Okay.
She sounded brown.
And you know the fight to cut NPR's funding entirely, he's just taking a shot at the Young Turks there, because Ben's dad, Frank Mankiewicz, is the person who ran NPR, started all their most popular programs. If I don't listen regularly, what are their most popular programs?
All things considered, Morning Edition, sort of.
Yeah, so he's Frank Mankiewicz started all this.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, but Trump, we're not going to let you cut it. Although, as I just told you, I don't listen.
Okay, I have an interview with Big Bird scheduled for this weekend, so we'll be fine.
PBS.
That's why it's actually bad politics, because people do care about Big Bird, yes. And they're going to get pissed. Absolutely. Okay, let's keep going. Let's do one more story.
Okay, so the next story is one that would be blaring headline news in a sane country, I think, but apparently that's not our current situation. So there was a report in the Military Times that was sadly underemphasized, and Military Times reports that approximately 100 elite Army Rangers are in Manbij, which is a city in Syria, to keep the peace, quote unquote, between Syrian Kurdish forces and those loyal to Turkey. That's according to Navy Captain Jeff Davis, a Pentagon spokesperson. Most notable is that Russian troops are in the very same city, and they are there providing security for humanitarian convoys that have entered the war-torn city, a development that he called unsurprising in light of recent high-level talks between military commanders from Russia, Turkey, and the U.S. So just think about that for a moment. United States armed military personnel are now extremely physically proximate to Russian forces in the very same very same city, in one of the most volatile places in the entire world. So what could that lead to? If there is some kind of miscommunication or a mishap or some kind of maybe friendly fire incident, it's not unimaginable to foresee that resulting in some kind of unexpected confrontation between U.S. forces and Russian forces, given how physically proximate they are. And I think this is one of the reasons why I and Jordan and some others have been cautioning for people not to get ahead of themselves in ramping up this Russia-related fear-mongering on the domestic front. Because the result of that is going to be Trump is going to feel pressure to demonstrate his anti-Russia bona fides. And if there's ever a situation that arises where there's some kind of military incident in, say, this particular city, Trump could feel compelled to take rash military action, and who knows what that could escalate in. So that's one point.
Yeah, so that's one side of it. The other side of it is it's never a good idea to have that many armies next to each other. Yeah. And so it's not just that it's US and Russia and we've been kind of enemies for a while. I guess now we're BFFs, but do people say that anymore? Best friends forever?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
All right.
Millennials still use it.
Yeah, Trump, I guess, would be Biffy, appropriately, and Putin would be Buffy. But you also have the Turkish army coming in, and you also have the Kurdish forces there and Syrian forces there. So you've got all of these different factions and literal armies with tanks. And the Americans have this giant American flag like, hey, do not fire at these. These are American. Don't mess with us. But you know what it does, though, is it gives somebody an incentive to take a pot shot at our guys. Mm-hmm. Now we got 1,000 guys there. Remember, Obama said there was no boots on the ground. I don't know. Are they wearing slippers? Because there's 1,000 of them, and they appear to be on the ground. Right. So Obama's the one who ordered them in the first place. Now Trump has who said he wasn't going to get involved, is getting further involved. He brought in more troops. So now all of a sudden there's real Americans with real tanks sitting in the middle of the real civil war in Syria. And any one of those guys could take a shot at our guys, and then we fire back, and then we accidentally hit who knows who, and then they fire back, and then, oh my God, we're in the middle of a holy hell.
And when have U.S. forces successfully mediated civil strife in another country? I mean, the track record of that particular tactic is just so abysmal. The idea that there are people in positions of power who still feel that that's a worthwhile exercise is just baffling.
So I just have one question, though. I'm not taking opinion on this, but what would happen if the U.S. forces weren't there?
So yeah, that's a good question, and I think that it's an interesting one, and I don't want people thinking that this is a black and white issue, and there are no downsides to any of these proposals. There's downside to every proposal. It is possible, and the reason we're there in the first place, and I believe them, is that if we weren't there, the two sides that are the Syrian sides would immediately clash. And when they did, well, then Turkey, who is not in favor of the Kurds, considers the Kurds in that particular area to be terrorists. Anyone who you're opposed to is now a terrorist, of course. But anyway, there are real Kurdish terrorists inside Turkey, but we're in a totally different country here in Syria. But anyway, they're all terrorists according to the Turkish government. So they come down, and so they would say, well, I got to go get the terrorists. They're fighting against the people that I support, right? Mm-hmm. So now Turkey's there, and now you got Bashar Assad's guys, mm-hmm. Russia, Turkey. So what America is, I think, legitimately trying to do here is, hey, everybody cool it, okay? Turkey, you're our ally. You don't want to be firing at American tanks. That's a disaster for you. So don't cross this line, right. and including your Syrian friends. And everybody's got Syrian friends on all different sides. So they are trying to keep the peace. To Michael's point, we don't have a great track record of doing that. I mean, look at what happened in Lebanon. You remember when Reagan was in right. office, and we sent Marines there, and they were sitting there like sitting ducks. They get bombed by Hezbollah. And then Reagan goes, and probably what Trump will do is my best guess, is if they get bombed, Reagan was like, we got to cut and run. This is what am I going to do? I'm in the middle of a Syrian war, a civil war. So they left.
And the burden of proof should be on those who are asserting that military intervention is warranted. It shouldn't be on the people who are skeptics to say what would happen if military if troops were not there. Well, I mean, you're the one who's saying that they ought to be there, so you need to justify that.
But also, this goes back to broken campaign promises. I mean, believe it or not, I can't tell you how many people I interviewed at Trump rallies, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin. They were like, you know, I want focus on my jobs, my schools. I don't want money overseas. And that's what Trump was telling them, that he wasn't going to be sending troops elsewhere. All he said was, I'm going to bomb the hell out of them. But
they
he
want
said,
that too, though.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I went to a dinner party last week, and someone said that at the table, a Trump supporter, I think we should just bomb the whole area. I'm like, what whole area? We've all heard this before.
Right. Yeah. But they specifically said, we don't want any more troops overseas. We don't want getting entangled around the world. We just want to bomb them. Obviously, those two things don't really make sense. But
yeah, you got to be inordinately careful here, because it is if you're going to do this, as Michael points out, which is a giant if, right? You have to be exceedingly careful in how you strike that balance, because if we're right and anything slightly goes wrong and all of a sudden our guys are fired upon and three of them die, mm-hmm. 38 of them die, right? Now Trump is in a no-win situation. So if he pulls out and says, well, I told you I wasn't going to get involved in that mess, people go, you let 38 of our guys die and you did nothing? That's incredibly weak. Mm-hmm. Or then he has to say, okay, then I'm staying. And I'm going to bring in troops, more troops, because I'm going to show them how strong I am, and I'm not going to let them attack the Americans. And who did it? The Russians did it. Then I'm going to attack. Wait, I've worked for them. But anyway, so either way, though, it's not a good situation for Trump. It's a really perilous situation. Now, do you trust that Trump is going to walk that line carefully and judiciously?
I mean, Obama couldn't. It was his biggest regret that he wasn't able. I mean, the Syrian refugee crisis, he thinks, is the biggest regret of his presidency, that they didn't intervene. It is a very tricky situation here. It's not like one or the other. And I don't have an answer, and I have really no opinion on this, because it's disastrous either way.
The thing is, Democrats domestically are making this situation much more fraught and much more dangerous by fomenting this utterly deranged climate around Russia in Congress, even in some state houses, in the media. It's beyond absurd. So the incentive that Trump is working within now is to demonstrate his hostility toward Russia and his antagonism toward Russia should something like this arise.
He's been criticized for Russia for the past 2 months. In the most tricky, listen, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. You can have a relationship with Russia, which he clearly has. No, like, you are blind if you don't see that. And you cannot use it as a defense as the Democratic Party is. I think the Democratic Party needs to start talking about other things, not just Russia, which is very convenient to their narrative right now, which basically removes all responsibility for any actions that they need to take. But that doesn't mean that we have to be blind to intelligence information.
Well, but the Democrats are creating a dangerous situation is the point. They need to talk about other things, but the way in which they are talking about Russia is increasing the likelihood of some kind of cataclysmic military confrontation when you have U.S. troops and Russian forces literally in the same city in Syria.
I actually, we have obviously total disagreement on the panel on the Russia issue. And I disagree with you so thoroughly that I don't think it's as much of an issue as you think it is. So here's what I mean by that. So follow my chain of logic here. I actually think he really is in bed with the Russians, so that if the Russians fired and even killed Americans, then he really wouldn't do much about it. So that sounds like an outrageous, what, Trump would have to do alpha male and he's going to show him. I don't think he would.
So in order to placate the Democrats, what Trump would have to do is take stronger military action in retaliation against Russia?
He's not placating the Democrats.
But in order to placate you and to placate Democrats, he would have to do it. Wait, that's why the situation is so dangerous.
It's based on the assumption that Donald Trump actually cares about the Democrats. Newsflash, the Republicans are doing whatever they want without the Democrats. They've been doing it forever because the Democrats have no power because they're only using the Russian argument. If they actually talked about issues, then maybe they would have
more Democrats
power.
Are aligning with certain segments of the Republican Party to pressure Trump on Russia, and that's where he has incentive to assert his belligerence toward Putin.
So let me just agree with Michael in part there. I think the Democrats do warmonger and are in bed with McCain and Graham to try to push us towards more hostility with Russia, and that's disgusting, and we all are against that, right? But I also want to be clear about my position, for example. So I think that Trump definitely has to deal with the Russians. Now, I could be wrong, and I don't have all the evidence on financial transactions. Super clear on that, okay? My belief is that he has some arrangement with the Russians. Okay, now, that doesn't mean I want you to go kill Russians. Right. No. Don't start a war with the Russians. You don't have to prove anything to me, Donald, okay? So power down and get those guys out of the middle of that mess, because they're going to get hit.
Well, two things are true. Number one, his son, I think a few years ago, said some of the largest deals we do are in Russia. So there's definitely financial dealings that he has tried to cover up. But other than that, the fear mongering and the hysteria has been on, oh, Russia hacked our election and all this stuff that, you know, Cenk and I might disagree with the severity of that. But what it comes down to is, if something happens with Russia, it comes down to, oh, Trump either is going to go with possible business dealings with Russia, or he's a giant narcissist, egomaniac who wants to look strong. And which one of those two things is going to win over? I think it's the narcissist, whip my thing out and I'm going to be strong. But no matter what Rex Tillerson tells him.
The thing is, nobody has ever denied that Trump has had business dealings with various oligarchic Russians. I mean, he's bragged about that. His family has bragged about that. So that's not been covered up. What's happened is that Democrats and liberals have concocted this narrative where they make dealings with Russians to be somehow uniquely nefarious. And that's how they've tried to fuel this narrative of Trump, quote, being in bed or having an arrangement with Russians.
But it's not just Trump.
Okay, so this is, we 100% disagree on this.
What's the crux of the disagreement, though?
Michael,
I don't get it.
The reason is because it is uniquely nefarious, literally, because it helped swing an election. So thereby making it uniquely nefarious. And look, I don't think that they hacked us, so we certainly don't have evidence of that. And they did propaganda, and we do propaganda. So I'm not saying that it's like I've never heard of anything like this, and egads, gadzooks, and I'm shocked and chagrined. I understand that he has business dealings with Russia. Russia wants the sanctions lifted. Russia helps him during the election. So far, we all agree. And by the way, he will almost certainly lift the sanctions. So that's a uniquely nefarious deal. Do we have a deal with that like that with Tanzania? Do we have a deal like that with any other country?
China? He's also objectifying China.
Saudi Arabia, three.
I mean, isn't it Russia's own intention to make China the enemy also? And that is another narrative that he has pushed out there, something that President Obama, it was discussed today in the news, that President Obama worked very hard to make sure the Asian Pacific region was stable, and now China's thinking of pulling out of APAC.
But when you say help swing the election, I mean, what does that mean? It's not like Vladimir Putin was in Michigan behind people as they pulled down the lever. That doesn't mean anything. That's just Democrats deflecting from the fact that Hillary Clinton lost to a reality TV star, Cheeto. I mean, I get what you're saying, propaganda, this and that, but there's no exit polls that show WikiLeaks played a big role. James Comey played a bigger role.
Real quick, let me address that, okay? Because, Jordan, everything swung the election. So I'm not trying to deflect anything from Hillary Clinton. She 1,000% blew it. It is totally her responsibility. She was the candidate. The Democratic Party blew it. I'm not in that camp, right? But that does not mean that the Russians didn't also help to swing the election towards Trump. Now, you could say so did Comey, so did her, the fact that she didn't visit a union hall in Michigan, and so did all these factors. And you're right about that. And what I'm saying is, the Russians doing fake news, doing the leaks, etc., was one of the factors. The leaks, I didn't mind at all because they were real news. The fake news, I minded. It was literally not real. But okay, that's part. Wait, Hillary Clinton's was supposed to fight beyond that and actually win, and she's running against a complete clown. So I'm not excusing anything she did, but that doesn't mean that the Russians didn't want Trump to win, because they most clearly did.
I think they took advantage of a situation in which they knew that the Democratic Party was at its weakest state. They were looking at the numbers, saying, this is a party that has lost 1,000 seats, raised all this money, doesn't have any investment statewide for organizing, and they're losing members under 40. So what do they do? They targeted those people under 40 consuming news online, and this has been reported on, with this fake news to spread out that propaganda. Now, did it influence the election? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know if I agree with you with that, Cenk. I really don't. I think that they're at fault. But I think you're putting a foreign policy issue and a Democratic Party issue, and you're muddling them together, and they're not. It's not the same thing. The Democrats are using this as an excuse. It also is a true excuse that Donald Trump has been influenced by the Russians. There is look at the cabinet picks.
Financially, absolutely.
You know, I'm sorry.
Influenced by the Russians, though, what does that exactly mean?
When they pay for your speeches, a year before, when you're making $75,000 in speeches per speech in Russia, when you're sitting next to Vladimir Putin at a dinner where you're honoring Vladimir Putin in RTTV, when you have a deal with RTTV, a propaganda outlet, literally, that is what is fueled by Russia. That person's a national security advisor, not to mention Rex Tillerson having the largest deal with Russia, oil deal, in the history of history.
So is that not evidence? If Mike Flynn had given a paid speech in Israel and was compensated just as much as he was compensated for this Moscow speech, would you be just as incensed?
If there were 15 people on the cabinet and in the national security advisor's positions that also had deals like that, and Israel was trying to literally break apart the geopolitical situation. It's world power.
Breaking apart the geopolitical situation. See, this is where people who proclaim to be experts on the motives of, quote, the Russians. And imagine if people in Russia were saying, the Americans. What does the Americans mean? The American state is this huge multifarious entity with countervailing motives and competing interests. And it's the same thing with Russia. So this reductive interpretation of what their motives are, what Putin's are, by these amateur experts, is just beyond.
Kill our journalists, and they do.
Can somebody get me on that?
We just bomb them and drone them and kill them and imprison them. I mean, no big deal.
Journalists?
Right. Yes.
So this could.
Let's
go
all
on.
Get a white Russian after this.
Trump would like that.
But hold on,
it's like white and Russian. Okay.
But there's more to the story here. We have graphic office. 8.
Okay, right? Hold on. I just want to say just real quick. Okay, look, and we got to wrap this up. But Michael, in the case of the U.S., yes, there's a lot of different forces at play, right? Mm-hmm. In the case of Russia, there's one guy in charge. I mean, there's not a lot of countervailing forces. Are you saying that Putin is not completely in charge, that there's some, if there's countervailing forces, he either executed them or put them in prison?
I'm saying this attribution of motive to the Russians as if it's this single homogenous entity that can be reduced in that way is silly.
Normally not the case, but under Putin, yeah, the case. Under Yeltsin, no, there was a lot of different things going on, right? But under Putin, yeah, he's got a clear motive and he's pushing that.
So then say Putin, don't say the Russians. I mean, what does the Russians mean? That's a propaganda derogatory term to make people irrationally fearful of Russians as somehow inherently sinister. And that's
like
what I object to.
It's not the people of Russia. It's not the people.
Then don't say the Russians. Why are you saying the Russians
Putin,
then?
Who runs the country, who's a
Would you want to be called the Americans and have you conflated with the American government?
But again, no one's conflating Cenk with Donald Trump. No, I mean, or Lindsey Graham with Donald Trump. Putin literally dictates who is under his in his government.
Okay, but we really should just finish the story because this is really important. I mean, graphic 8. Okay, so and speaking of the deranged hysteria, which I absolutely insist is the case in this, Mike Morrell, who was an advisor to the Hillary Clinton campaign, former CIA director, came out, and this was reported by NBC News last night. He said, quote, on the question of the Trump campaign conspiring with the Russians here, there is smoke, but there is no fire at all. There's no little campfire, there's no little candle, there's no spark, and there's a lot of people looking for it. Now remember, for Mike Morrell to make that admission is hugely significant because he in large part sparked this hysteria in the first place back in August when he wrote a column for the New York Times headlined, I ran the CIA, now I'm endorsing Hillary Clinton, and he asserted within that column, in the intelligence business, we would say that Mr. Putin had recruited Mr. Trump as an unwitting agent of the Russian Federation. A few months later, he said that Russia's collusion and potential collusion with Trump was, quote, the political equivalent of 9/11. So if now even Mike Morrell, who was probably the most central figure in initiating this mind-boggling hysteria that is consuming the Democratic Party, if even now he admits that we should probably tamp down expectations of what will be uncovered here, I don't know, maybe it's time for a wake-up call.
Well, Michael Isikoff reported on this last year in April, and he's no friend of the Clintons. He's the one who broke the story.
Broke what story?
The Russia story.
Well, what specific story?
The General Flynn.
Yeah, he broke the
story. He broke
story.
All of this.
And
he's
Isikoff,
not a Clinton friend.
Isikoff also had the Monica Lewinsky story, which exactly. The Clintons
but
have not really.
But I also think in terms of the media, James Clapper also came out and said there's no evidence of collusion. That was barely covered. Same thing with this.
Yeah. No, I think Michael and Jordan's point on Morrell and Clapper are totally fair. And so I think the jury's still out. I think I can give a lot of reasons why I think that is not indicative of the final answer and why he might say that. But I'm going to take the point and not even get into the minutia. Totally fair point. So I think that there is an issue. But I think that what I really want to do is get some sort of agreement here that nobody at this table, I don't think, is saying the Democratic Party is just fine. If it wasn't for those dastardly Russians, we would have won the election and everything would have been fine. And
some have said, not us.
At this table.
Right. Table.
So the thing that I think infuriates all four of us is when the Democratic Party says, no, it wasn't that we were too elitist. It wasn't that we didn't run a populist campaign. It wasn't that we weren't that we were the establishment. It was the damn Russians.
Right.
And so that no one here believes.
Well, I want to make one thing clear. When I'm saying, I think it's very likely there's financial dealings between Trump and Russia, and that could affect his decisions as president. That is 100%. What infuriates me is being around the country and seeing misery, corruption, and injustice everywhere. Yeah. North Dakota, Flint, East Chicago, wherever I am. It's not rainbows and sunshine. And I get emails that night from the Democratic Party, which should be talking about these things, but they're talking about Russia. Sure, if they want to talk about Russia here and there or Trump's, a pinata, make Trump a pinata, that's politics. But they're not focusing on the bread table and economic issues. And that's why they lost.
Yep.
And by the way, there's a reason why they do that. So again, to end on agreement here. So the reason they do that is because if you talk about Flint and all the other places, then you got to start talking about the donors. But they have the same donors. So they don't, tackling the actual problems is deeply problematic for them because they have conflicts of interest on most of those problems. If you're talking about the skyrocketing drug prices, well, a lot of the Democratic senators voted to block drugs from Canada, which would have saved us a lot of money.
Cory Booker.
So now on the other hand, the defense contractors want hostilities with Russia, to Michael's point. Yep. So that's a win-win for them. Russia, bad guys, right there. And plus, that helps our donors.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So,
and here's another crucial point. And I've been covering these town hall meetings across the country, mostly California as of late, Democratic and Republican meetings. And you have these grassroots groups who have formed to counter the Trump agenda, Indivisible and other organizations sending activists to these meetings. And every meeting that I've gone to thus far, without exception, the single most discussed issue among these most activated members of the Democratic Party's base is Russia. Okay? So people constantly tell me on the internet, oh, you're focusing too much on this fixation. That means you're fixated. No, I'm reacting to a fixation that is plainly evident out there in the public. Initially, this hysteria was contained mostly to the elite classes, but at this point, it's now trickled down to the grassroots. So you have liberal activists running around with Trump plus Putin equals treason signs, Soviet insignia. I mean, the most outlandish stuff possible that we would associate with the deranged elements of the right are now being replicated in this bizarre way on the left. So that's concerning because it's putting the Democrats in an even worse predicament than they were prior to the election because they're feeding into this hysterical narrative and they're letting it consume them and distract from what they could actually do to improve their tarnished image in the wider public.
You know what I think is funny? At the DNC debate, no one ever talked about Russia. They talked about losing races.
Oh, wow. Okay. Hey, that's a nice positive note. Okay. A positive note for the Democrats on all the races they lose.
Internally.
Right. Okay. Well, we got to take a break here. I'm not sure we've ever been this overtime. Okay. So, but politics continues. We've got a lot more on those issues, including the cancer patient and how he took on Republicans on their bill. I think that is so telling. And I actually want to go back to a story about how the Republicans want Donald Trump to actually not listen to the Constitution actively and stop democracy. But I will explain that when we come back.